In front of me, softly shaped gray furniture was evolving from the floor like a sculpture from a pool of mercury. A plain metal table first, then two chairs this side, one opposite. Their edges and surfaces ran liquidly smooth for the final seconds of their emergence, then snapped solid and geometric as they took on an existence separate from the floor. Ortega appeared beside me, at first a pale pencil sketch of a woman, all flickering lines and diffident shading. As I watched, pastel colors raced through her, and her movements grew more defined. She was turning to speak to me, one hand reaching into the pocket of her jacket. I waited, and the final gloss of color popped out onto her surfaces. She produced her cigarettes. "Smoke?" "No, thanks. I..." Realizing the futility of worrying about virtual health, I accepted the pack and shook one out. Ortega lit us both with her lighter, and the first bite of smoke in my lungs was ecstasy. I looked up at the geometric sky. "Is this standard?"
"Pretty much."
Ortega squinted into the distance.
"Resolution looks a bit higher than usual. Think Mickey's showing off."
Cadman scribbled into existence on the other side of the table. Before the virtual program had even colored him in properly, he became aware of us and folded his arms across his chest. If my appearance in the cell was putting him off balance, as hoped, it didn't show.
"Again, Lieutenant," he said when the program had rendered him complete. "There is a UN ruling on maximum virtual time for one arrest, you know."
"That's right, and we're still a long way off it," Ortega said. "Why don't you sit down, Cadman?"
"No, thank you."
"I said sit, motherfucker!"
There was an abrupt undercurrent of steel in the cop's voice, and magically Cadman blinked off and reappeared seated at the table.
His face betrayed a momentary flash of rage at the displacement, but then it was gone, and he unfolded his arms in an ironic gesture.
"You're right. It's so much more comfortable like this. Won't you both join me?"
We took our seats in the more conventional way, and I stared at Cadman as we did it. It was the first time I'd seen anything quite like it. He was the patchwork man. Most virtual systems recreate you from self-images held in the memory, with a common-sense subroutine to prevent your delusions from impinging too much. I generally come out a little taller and thinner in the face than I usually am. In this case, the system seemed to have scrambled a myriad different perceptions from Cadman's presumably long list of sleeves. I'd seen it done before, as a technique, but most of us grow rapidly attached to whatever sleeves we're living in, and that form blanks out previous incarnations. We are, after all, evolved to relate to the physical world. The man in front of me was different. His frame was that of a Caucasian Nordic, topping mine by nearly 30 centimeters. But the face was at odds. It began African, broad and deep ebony, but the color ended like a mask under the eyes, and the lower half was divided along the line of the nose, pale copper on the left, corpse white on the right. The nose was both fleshy and aquiline, and mediated well between the top and bottom halves of the face, but the mouth was a mismatch of left and right sides that left the lips peculiarly twisted. Long, straight black hair was combed mane-like back from the forehead, shot through on one side with pure white. The hands, immobile on the metal table, were equipped with claws similar to the ones I'd seen on the giant freak fighter in Licktown. But the fingers were long and sensitive. He had breasts, impossibly full on a torso so over-muscled. The eyes, set in jet skin, were a startling pale green. Cadman had freed himself from conventional perceptions of the physical.
In an earlier age, he would have been a shaman. Here, the centuries of technology had made him more.
An electronic demon, a malignant spirit that dwelled in altered carbon and emerged only to possess flesh and wreak havoc. He would have made a fine envoy. "I take it I don't have to introduce myself," I said quietly. Cadman grinned, revealing small teeth and a delicate pointed tongue.
If you're a friend of the lieutenant, you don't have to do anything you don't want to here. Only the slobs get their virtuality edited.
Do you know this man, Cadman?
Ortega asked. Hoping for a confession, Lieutenant? Cadman threw back his head and laughed musically.
Oh, the crudity! This man? This woman, maybe? Oh, yes. Even a dog could be trained to say as much as he has said, given the right tranquilizers, of course. They do tend to go pitifully insane when you decant them, if not. But yes, even a dog. We sit here, three silhouettes carved from electronic sleet in a different storm, and you talk like a cheap period drama. Limited vision, Lieutenant. Limited vision. Where is the voice that said altered carbon would free us from the cells of our flesh? The vision that said we would be angels?
You tell me, Cadman. You're the one with the exalted professional standing.
Ortega's tone was detached. She system-magicked a long scroll of printout into one hand and glanced idly down it.
Pimp, triad enforcer, virtual interrogator in the corporate wars. It's all quality work. Me, I'm just some dumb cop, can't see the light.
I'm not going to quarrel with you there, Lieutenant.
Says here you were a wiper for Meritcon a while back, scaring archaeologue miners off their claims in Syrtis Major, slaughtering their families by way of incentive. Nice job.
Ortega tossed the printout back into oblivion.
We've got you cold, Cadman. Digital footage from the hotel surveillance system, verifiable simultaneous leaving, both stacks on ice. That's an erasure mandatory. And even if your lawyers dance it down to compliance and machine error, the sun's going to be a red dwarf by the time they let you off stack.
Cadman smiled. Then what are you here for? Who sent you? I asked him softly.
The dog speaks. Is it a wolf I hear, howling his lonely communion with the unpiloted stars? Or merely the self-importance and servitude in the bark of a dog? How many millennia did it take, twisting and torturing the pride from the one, to make a tool, the other?
I inhaled smoke and nodded. Like most Harlanites, I knew Quell's poems and other prevarications more or less by heart. It was taught in schools in lieu of the later and weightier political works, most of which were still deemed too radical to be put in the hands of children. This wasn't a great translation, but it captured the essence. More impressive was the fact that anyone not actually from Harlan's world could quote such an obscure volume. I finished it for him. And how do we measure the distance from spirit to spirit? And who do we find to blame?
Have you come seeking blame, Mr. Kovach?
Among other things.
How disappointing.
You expected something else?
No,
Cadman said with another smile.
Expectation is our first mistake. I meant, how disappointing for you.
Maybe.
He shook his great piebald head. Certainly. You will take no names from me. If you seek blame, I will have to bear it for you.
That's very generous, but you'll remember what Quell said about lackeys.
Kill them along the way, but count your bullets, for there are more worthy targets.
Cadman chuckled deep inside himself.
Are you threatening me in monitored police storage?
No, I'm just putting things into perspective. I knocked ash off my cigarette and watched it sparkle out of existence before it reached the floor. Someone's pulling your strings. That's who I'm going to wipe. You're nothing. You I wouldn't waste spit on. Cadman tipped his head back as a stronger tremor ran through the shifting lines on the sky, like cubist lightning. It reflected in the dull sheen on the metal table and seemed to touch his hands for a moment. When he looked down at me again, it was with a curious light in his eyes.
I was not asked to kill you, he said tonelessly, unless your abduction proved inconvenient. But now I will.
Ortega was on him as the last syllable left his mouth. The table blinked out of existence, and she kicked him backwards off the chair with one booted foot. As he rolled back to his feet, the same boot caught him in the mouth and floored him again. I ran my tongue around the almost healed gashes inside my own mouth and felt a distinct lack of sympathy. Ortega dragged Cadman up by the hair, the cigarette in her hand replaced by a vicious-looking blackjack, courtesy of the same system magic that had eliminated the table.
"I hear you right," she hissed. "You making threats, fuckhead?"
Cadman bared his teeth in a blood-stained grin.
"Police brute—"
"That's right, motherfucker!"
Ortega hit him across the cheek with a blackjack. The skin split.
"Police brutality in a monitored police virtuality. Sandy Kim and World Web One would have a field day, wouldn't they? But you know what? I reckon your lawyers aren't going to want to run this particular tape."
"Leave him alone, Ortega." She seemed to remember herself then and stepped back. Her face twitched and she drew a deep breath. The table blinked back, and Cadman was suddenly sitting upright again, mouth undamaged.
"You too," he said quietly.
"Yeah, sure."
There was contempt in Ortega's voice, at least half of it directed at herself, I guessed. She made a second effort to bring her breathing back under control, rearranged her clothing unnecessarily.
"Like I said, going to be a cold day in hell by the time you get the chance. Maybe I'll wait for you."
"Whoever sent you worth this much, Cadman?" I wondered softly. "You going down silent out of contractual loyalty, or are you just scared shitless?" For answer, the composite man folded his arms across his chest and stared through me.
"You through, Kovach?"
Ortega asked. I tried to meet Cadman's distant gaze. "Cadman, the man I work for has a lot of influence. This could be your last chance to cut a deal." "Nothing." He didn't even blink. I shrugged. "I'm through."
"Good," Ortega said grimly, "because sitting downwind of this piece of shit is beginning to eat away at my usually tolerant nature."
She waggled her fingers in front of his eyes.
"Be seeing you, fuckhead."
At that, Cadman's eyes turned up to meet hers, and a small, peculiarly unpleasant smile twisted his lips. We left. Back on the fourth floor, the walls of Ortega's office had reverted to a dazzling high noon over beaches of white sand. I screwed up my eyes against the glare while Ortega trawled through a desk drawer and came up with her own and a spare pair of sunglasses.
"So what did you learn from that?"
I fitted the lenses uncomfortably over the bridge of my nose. They were too small. "Not much, except that little gem about not having orders to wipe me. Someone wanted to talk to me. I'd pretty much guessed that anyway, else he could have just blown my stack out all over the lobby of the Hendrix. Still, means someone wanted to cut a deal of their own outside of Bancroft."
"Or someone wanted to interrogate the guts out of you."
I shook my head. "About what? I'd only just arrived. Doesn't make any sense."
"The car? Unfinished business?"
Ortega made little flicking motions with her hand, as if she were dealing me the suggestions.
"Maybe a grudge match?"
"No, we went through this one when we were yelling at each other the other night. There are people who'd like to see me wiped, but none of them live on Earth, and none of them swing the kind of influence to go interstellar. And there's nothing I know about the Corps that isn't in a low-wall database somewhere. And anyway, it's just too much of a fucking coincidence. Now, this is about Bancroft. Someone wanted in on the program."
"Whoever had him killed?"
I tipped my head down to look at her directly over the sun lenses. "You believe me, then?"
"Not entirely."
"Oh, come on." But Ortega wasn't listening.
"What I want to know," she brooded, "is why he rewrote his codes at the end. You know, we've sweated him nearly a dozen times since we downloaded him Sunday night. That's the first time he's come close to even admitting he was there."
"Even to his lawyers?"
"We don't know what he says to them. They're big-time sharks out of Ulaanbaatar in New York.
That kind of money carries a scrambler into all privy virtual interviews. We get nothing on tape but static.
I raised a mental eyebrow. On Harlan's world, all virtual custody was monitored as a matter of course. Scramblers were not permitted, no matter how much money you were worth. Speaking of lawyers, are Cadmans here in Bay City?
Physically, you mean? Yeah, they've got a deal with the Marin County practice. One of their partners is renting a sleeve here for the duration.
Ortega's lip curled.
Physical meetings are considered a touch of class these days. Only the cheap firms do business down the wires.
What's this suit's name? There was a brief pause while she hung on to the name.
Cadman's a spinning item right now. I'm not sure we go this far.
Ortega, we go all the way. That was the deal. Otherwise, I'm back to risking Elias's fine features with some more maximal push investigation. She was silent for a while.
Rutherford, she said finally. You want to talk to Rutherford?
Right now I want to talk to anyone. Maybe I didn't make things clear earlier. I'm working cold here. Bancroft waited a month and a half before he brought me in. Cadman's all I've got.
Keith Rutherford's a handful of engine grease. You won't get any more out of him than you did Cadman downstairs. And anyway, how the fuck am I supposed to introduce you, Kovach? Hi, Keith. This is the ex-envoy, Luce Cannon, your client tried to wipe on Sunday. He'd like to ask you a few questions. He'll close up faster than an unpaid hooker's hole.
She had a point. I thought about it for a moment, staring out to sea. All right, I said slowly. All I need is a couple of minutes' conversation. How about you tell him I'm Elias Riker, your partner from Organic Damage? I practically am, after all. Ortega took off her lenses and stared at me.
Are you trying to be funny?
No, I'm trying to be practical. Rutherford's sleeving in from Milan Batur, right?
New York, she said tightly.
New York, right. So he probably doesn't know anything about you or Riker.
Probably not.
So what's the problem?
The problem is, Kovach, that I don't like it.
There was more silence. I dropped my gaze into my lap and let out a sigh that was only partially manufactured. Then I took off my own sunglasses and looked up at her. It was all there on plain display. The naked fear of sleeving and all that it entailed. Paranoid essentialism with its back to the wall.
Ortega, I said gently, I'm not him. I'm not trying to be hit.
You couldn't even come close, she snapped. All we're talking about is a couple of hours make-believe.
Is that all?
She said it in a voice like iron, and she put her sunglasses back on with such brusque efficiency that I didn't need to see the tears welling up in the eyes behind the mirror lenses.
All right,
she said finally, clearing her throat.
I'll get you in. I don't see the point, but I'll do it. Then what?
That's a little difficult to say. I'll have to improvise.
Like you did at the Y Clinic?
I shrugged noncommittally. Envoy techniques are largely reactive. I can't react to something until it happens.
I don't want another bloodbath, Kovach. It looks bad on the city's stats.
If there's violence, it won't be me that starts it.
That's not much of a guarantee. Haven't you got any idea what you're going to do?
I'm going to talk.
Just talk?
She looked at me disbelievingly.
That's all?
I fitted my ill-fitting sunglasses back over my face. Sometimes that's all it takes, I said.
Chapter 18. I met my first lawyer when I was 15. He was a harried-looking juvenile affray expert who defended me, not unhandily, in a minor organic damage suit involving a new pest police officer. He bargained them down with a kind of myopic patience to conditional release and 11 minutes of virtual psychiatric counseling. In the hall outside the juvenile court, he looked into my probably infuriatingly smug face and nodded as if his worst fears about the meaning of his life were being confirmed. Then he turned on his heel and walked away. I forget his name. My entry into the new pest gang scene shortly afterwards precluded any more such legal encounters. The gangs were web-smart, wired up, and already writing their own intrusion programs, or buying them from kids half their age in return for low-grade virtual porn ripped off the networks. They didn't get caught easily, and in return for this favor, the new pest heat tended to leave them alone. Inter-gang violence was largely ritualized and excluded other players most of the time. On the odd occasion that it spilled over and affected civilians, there would be a rapid and brutal series of punitive raids that left a couple of lead gang heroes in the store and the rest of us with extensive bruising. Fortunately, I never worked my way up the chain of command far enough to get put away, so the next time I saw the inside of a courtroom was the internet inquiry. The lawyers I saw there had about as much in common with a man who had defended me at 15 as automated machine rifle fire has with farting. They were cold, professionally polished, and well on their way up a career ladder that would ensure that despite the uniforms they wore, they would never have to come within 1,000 kilometers of a genuine firefight. The only problem they had as they cruised sharkishly back and forth across the cool marble floor of the court was in drawing the fine differences between war, mass murder of people wearing a uniform not your own, justifiable loss, mass murder of your own troops, but with substantial gains, and criminal negligence, mass murder of your own troops without appreciable benefit. I sat in that courtroom for 3 weeks listening to them dress it like a variety of salads, and with each passing hour the distinctions, which at one point I'd been pretty clear on, grew increasingly vague. I suppose that proves how good they were. After that, straightforward criminality came as something of a relief. Something bothering you? Ortega glanced sideways at me as she brought the unmarked cruiser down on a shelving pebble beach below the split-level glass-fronted offices of Pendergrast Sanchez, attorneys at law. Just thinking. Try cold showers and alcohol. Works for me. I nodded and held up the minuscule bead of metal I had been rolling between my finger and thumb. Is this legal? Ortega reached up and killed the primaries. More or less. No one's going to complain. Good. Now, I'm going to need verbal cover to start with. You do the talking. I'll just shut up and listen. Take it from there. Fine. Riker was like that anyway. Never used two words if one would do it. Most of the time with the scumbags, he'd just look at them. Sort of a Mickey Nozawa type, huh? Who? Never mind. The rattle of upthrown pebbles on the hull died away as Ortega cut the engines to idle. I stretched in my seat and threw open my side of the hatch. Climbing out, I saw an over-burly figure coming down the meandering set of wooden steps from the split level. Looked like grafting. A blunt-looking gun was slung over his shoulder, and he wore gloves. Probably not a lawyer. Go easy, Ortega said, suddenly at my shoulder. We have jurisdiction here. He isn't going to start anything. She flashed her badge as the muscle jumped the last step to the beach and landed on flexed legs. You could see the disappointment on his face as he saw it. Bay City Police, we're here to see Rutherford.
You can't park that here.
I already have, Ortega told him evenly. Are we going to keep Mr. Rutherford waiting?
There was a prickly silence, but she'd gauged him correctly. Contenting himself with a grunt, the muscle gestured us up the staircase and followed at prudent shepherding distance. It took a while to get to the top, and I was pleased to see when we arrived that Ortega was considerably more out of breath than I was. We went across a modest sun deck made from the same wood as the stairs, and through two sets of automatic plate glass doors into a reception area, styled to look like someone's lounge. There were rugs on the floor, knitted in the same patterns as my jacket, and amethyst prints on the walls. 5 single armchairs provided parking.
Can I help you?
This was a lawyer, no question about it. A smoothly groomed blonde woman in a loose skirt and jacket tailored to fit the room, hands resting comfortably in her pockets.
Bay City Police, where's Rutherford?
The woman flickered a glance sideways at our escort, and having received the nod, did not bother to demand identification.
I'm afraid Keith is occupied at the moment. He's in virtual with New York.
Well, get him out of virtual, then, Ortega said with dangerous mildness, and tell him the officer who arrested his client is here to see him. I'm sure he'll be interested.
That may take some time, officer.
No, it won't. The two women locked gazes for a moment, and then the lawyer looked away. She nodded to the muscle, who went back outside, still looking disappointed.
I'll see what I can do, she said glacially. Please wait here.
We waited. Ortega at the floor-to-ceiling window, staring down at the beach with her back to the room, and myself prowling the artwork. Some of it was quite good. With the separately ingrained habits of working in monitored environments, neither of us said anything for the 10 minutes it took to produce Rutherford from the inner sanctum. Lieutenant Ortega. The modulated voice reminded me of Miller's at the clinic, and when I looked up from a print over the fireplace, I saw much the same kind of sleeve. Maybe a little older, with slightly craggier patriarchal features designed to inspire instant respect in jurors and judges alike, but the same athletic frame and off-the-rack good looks.
To what do I owe this unexpected visit? Not more harassment, I hope.
Ortega ignored the allegation.
Detective Sergeant Elias Riker, she said, nodding at me. Your client just admitted to one count of abduction and made a first-degree organic damage threat under monitor. Care to see the footage?
Not particularly. Care to tell me why you're here?
Rutherford was good. He'd barely reacted. Barely. But enough to catch it out of the corner of my eye. My mind went into overdrive. Ortega leaned on the back of an armchair.
For a man defending a mandatory erasure case, you're showing a real lack of imagination.
Rutherford sighed theatrically.
You have called me away from an important link. I assume you do have something to say.
Do you know what third-party retroassociative complicity is? I asked the question without turning from the print, and when I did look up, I had Rutherford's complete attention.
I do not, he said stiffly.
That's a pity, because you and the other partners of Bozala Bennett are right in the firing line if Cadman rolls over. But of course, if that happens... I spread my hands and shrugged. It'll be open season. In fact, it may already be.
All right, that's enough.
Rutherford's hand rose decisively to a remote summons emitter pinned to his lapel. Our escort was on his way.
I don't have time to play games with you. There is no statute by that name, and this is getting perilously close to harassment.
I raised my voice. Just wanted to know which side you want to be on when the program crashes, Rutherford. There is a statute, UN indictable offense, last handed down 4th of May, 2207. Look it up. I had to go back a long way to dig this one up, but it'll take all of you down in the end. Cadman knows it. That's why he's cracking.
Rutherford smiled. I don't think so, Detective.
I repeated my shrug. Shame. Like I said, look it up. Then decide which side you want to play for. We're going to need inside corroboration, and we're prepared to pay for it. If it isn't you, Ulaanbaatar's stuffed with lawyers who'll give blowjobs for the chance.
The smile wavered fractionally.
That's right, think about it. I nodded at Ortega. You can get me at Fell Street, same as the lieutenant here. Elias Riker, off-world liaison. I'm promising you this is going to go down, whatever happens. And when it does, I'll be a good person to know.
Ortega took the cue like she'd been doing it all her life, like Sarah would have done. She unleaned herself from the chair back and made for the door.
Be seeing you, Rutherford,
she said laconically, as we stepped back out onto the deck. The muscle was there, grinning widely and flexing his hands at his sides.
And you, don't even think about it.
I contented myself with the silent look that I had been told Riker used to such great effect, and followed my partner down the stairs. Back in the cruiser, Ortega snapped on a screen and watched identity data from the bug scroll down.
Where'd you put it?
Print over the fireplace, corner of the frame. She grunted.
They'll sweep it out of there and nothing flat, you know. And none of it's admissible as evidence anyway.
I know. You've told me that twice already. That's not the point. If Rutherford rattled, he'll jump first.
You think he rattled?
A little.
Yeah.
She glanced curiously at me.
So what the fuck is third-party retroassociative complicity?
No idea. I made it up.
Her eyebrow went up.
No shit?
Convinced you, huh?
Know what?
You could have given me a polygraph test while I was spinning it, and I would have convinced that, too. Basic onboard tricks. Of course, Rutherford will know that as soon as he looks it up, but it's already served its purpose.
Which is what?
Provide the arena. Tell lies, you keep your opponent off balance. It's like fighting on unfamiliar ground. Rutherford was rattled, but he smiled when I told him this stuff was why Cadman was acting up. I looked up through the windshield at the house above, formulating the scrapings of intuition into understanding. He was fucking relieved when I said that. I don't suppose normally he would have given that much away, but the bluff had him running scared, and him knowing better than me about something was that little ray of stability he needed. And that means he knows another reason why Cadman changed behavior. He knows the real reason. Ortega grunted approvingly.
Pretty good, Kovac. You should have been a cop. You notice his reaction when I told him the good news about what Cadman had done? He wasn't surprised at all.
No, he was expecting it, or something like it.
Yeah.
She paused.
This really what you used to do for a living?
Sometimes. Diplomatic missions or deep cover stuff. It wasn't... I fell silent as she elbowed me in the ribs. On the screen, a series of coded sequences were unwinding like snakes of blue fire.
Here we go. Simultaneous calls. He must be doing this in virtual to save time. 1, 2, 3. That one's New York. Must be to update the senior partners. And, oops.
The screen flared and went abruptly dark. They found it, I said.
They did. The New York line probably has a sweeper attached. Flushes out the call vicinity on connection.
Or one of the others does.
Yeah.
Ortega punched up the screen's memory and stared at the call codes.
They're all three routed through discrete clearing. Take us a while to locate them. You want to eat?
Homesickness isn't something a veteran envoy should confess to. If the conditioning hasn't already ironed it out of you, the years of sleeving back and forth across the protectorate should have. Envoys are citizens of that elusive state here and now, a state that jealously admits of no dual nationalities. The past is relevant only as data. Homesickness was what I felt as we stepped past the kitchen area of the Flying Fish, and the aroma of sauces I had last tasted in Millsport hit me like a friendly tentacle. Teriyaki, frying tempura, and the undercut of miso. I stood wrapped in it for a moment, remembering that time. A ramen bar Sarah and I had skulked in while the heat from the Gemini Biosys gig died down. Eyes hooked to Newsnet broadcasts and a corner video phone with a smashed screen that was supposed to ring any time now. Steam on the windows and the company of taciturn Millsport skippers. And back beyond that, I remembered the moth-battered paper lanterns outside Watanabe's on a New Pest Friday night. My teenage skin slick with sweat from the jungle wind blowing out of the south, and my eyes glittering with tetrameth in one of the big wind-chime mirrors. Talk, cheaper than the big bowls of ramen, about big scores and Yazooka connections, tickets north and beyond, new sleeves and new worlds. Old Watanabe had sat out on the deck with us, listening to it all but never commenting, just smoking his pipes and glancing from time to time in the mirror at his own Caucasian features, always with mild surprise, it seemed to me. He never told us how he got that sleeve, just as he never denied or confirmed the rumors about his escapades with the Marine Corps, the Quell Memorial Brigade, the envoys, whatever. An older gang member once told us he'd seen Watanabe face down a room full of 7% angels with nothing but his pipe in his hands. And some kid from the swamp towns once came up with a fuzzy slice of newsreel footage he claimed was from the settlement wars. It was only 2D, hurriedly shot just before an assault team went over the top, but the sergeant being interviewed was subtitled Watanabe, Why, and there was something about the way he tilted his head when questioned that had us all crowing recognition at the screen. But then, Watanabe was a common enough name. And come to that, the guy who'd said he'd seen the angel's face down was also fond of telling us how he'd slept with a Harlan family heiress when she came slumming, and none of us believed that. Once, on a rare evening when I was both straight and alone at Watanabe's, I swallowed enough of my adolescent pride to ask the old man for his advice. I'd been reading UN Armed Forces promotional literature for weeks, and I needed someone to push me one way or the other. Watanabe just grinned at me around the stem of his pipe.
"I should advise you," he asked, "share with you the wisdom that brought me to this?"
We both looked around the little bar and the fields beyond the deck.
"Well, yes."
"Well, no,"
he said firmly, and resumed his pipe.
"Kovach?"
I blinked and found Ortega in front of me, looking curiously into my eyes.
"Something I need to know about?"
I smiled faintly and glanced around the kitchen's shining steel counters.
"Not really."
"It's good food,"
she said, misinterpreting the look.
"Well, let's get some, then."
She led me out of the steam and onto one of the restaurant's gantries. The flying fish was, according to Ortega, a decommissioned aerial minesweeper that some oceanographic institute had bought up. The institute was now either defunct or had moved on, and the bayward-facing facility had been gutted. But someone had stripped the flying fish, re-rigged her as a restaurant, and cabled her 500 meters above the decaying facility buildings. Periodically, the whole vessel was reeled gently back down to earth to disgorge its sated customers and take on fresh. There was a queue around two sides of the docking hangar when we arrived, but Ortega jumped it with her badge, and when the airship came floating down through the open roof of the hangar, we were the first aboard. I settled cross-legged onto cushions at a table that was secured to the blimp's hull on a metal arm, and thus did not touch the gantry at all. The gantry was cordoned with the faint haze of a power screen that kept the temperature decent and the gusting wind to a pleasant breeze. Around me, the hexagonal grating floor allowed me an almost uninterrupted view past the edge of the cushions to the sea, a kilometer below. I shifted uneasily. Heights had never been my strong point.
"Used to use it for tracking whales and stuff," Ortega said, gesturing sideways at the hull. "Back before places like this could afford the satellite time. Of course, with Understanding Day, the whales were suddenly big money for anyone who could talk to them. You know they've told us almost as much about the Martians as 4 centuries of archaeologues on Mars itself? Christ, they remember them coming here. Race memory, that is."
She paused.
"I was born on Understanding Day," she added inconsequentially.
"Really?"
"Yep, January 9th. They named me Kristen after some whale scientist in Australia, worked on the original translation team."
"Nice." Who she was really talking to caught up with her. She shrugged, abruptly dismissive.
"When you're a kid, you don't see it that way. I wanted to be called Maria."
"You come here often?"
"Not often, but I figured anyone out of Harlan's world would like it."
"Good guess." A waiter arrived and carved the menu into the air between us with a holotorch. I glanced briefly down the list and selected one of the ramen bowls at random. Something vegetarian.
"Good choice," Ortega said. She nodded at the waiter. "I'll have the same. And juice. You want anything to drink?"
"Water." Our selections flared briefly in pink and the menu disappeared. The waiter pocketed the holotorch at his breast with a snappy gesture and withdrew. Ortega looked around her, seeking neutral conversation.
"So, you got places like this in Millsport?"
"On the ground, yes. We're not big on aerial stuff."
"No?"
She raised her customary eyebrow.
"Millsport's an archipelago, isn't it? You would have thought airships were..."
"An obvious solution to the real estate shortage? Right as far as that goes, but I think you're forgetting something." I flickered my eyes skywards.
"We are not alone."
It clicked.
"The orbitals? They're hostile?"
"Let's say capricious. They tend to shoot down anything airborne that masses more than a helicopter. And since no one's ever been able to get close enough to decommission one of them, or even get aboard, come to that, we have no way of knowing what their exact programming parameters are. So we just play it safe and don't go up in the air much."
"Must make IP traffic tough."
I nodded. "Well, yeah. Of course, there isn't much traffic anyway. No other habitable planets in the system, and we're still too busy exploiting the world to bother about terraforming. Few exploration probes, and maintenance shuttles to the platforms. Bit of exotic element mining, that's about it. And there are a couple of launch windows down around the equator toward evening, and one crack-a-dawn slot up on the pole. It looks like a couple of orbitals must have crashed and burned way back when, left holes in the net. I paused. Or maybe someone shot them down.
Someone? You mean someone not the Martians?
I spread my hands. Why not? Everything we've ever found on Mars was raised or buried, or so well disguised we spent decades looking right at it before we even realized it was there. It's the same on most of the settled worlds. All the evidence points to some kind of conflict out there.
But the archaeologues say it was a civil war, a colonial war.
Yeah, right. I folded my arms and sat back. The archaeologues say what the Protectorate tells them to say, and right now it's fashionable to deplore the tragedy of the Martian domain tearing itself apart and sinking via barbarism into extinction. Big warning for the inheritors. Don't rebel against your lawful rulers for the good of all civilization. Ortega looked nervously around her. Conversation at some of the nearer tables had skittered and jarred to a halt. I gave the spectators a wide smile.
"Do you mind if we talk about something else?" Ortega asked uncomfortably.
"Sure. Tell me about Riker." The discomfort vanished into an icy stillness. Ortega put her hands flat on the table in front of her and looked at them.
"No, I don't think so," she said eventually.
"Fair enough." I watched cloud formations shimmer in the haze of the power screen for a while, and avoided looking down at the sea below me. "But I think you want to, really."
"How very male of you."
The food arrived, and we ate in silence, broken only by the traditional slurping. Despite the Hendrix's perfectly balanced auto-chef breakfast, I discovered I was ravenous. The food had triggered a hunger in me deeper than the needs of my stomach. I was draining the dregs of my bowl before Ortega had got halfway through hers.
"Food okay?"
she asked ironically, as I sat back. I nodded, trying to wipe away the skeins of memory associated with the ramen, but unwilling to bring the envoy conditioning online and spoil the sated feeling in my belly. Looking around at the clean metal lines of the dining gantry and the sky beyond, I was as close to totally contented as I had been since Miriam Bancroft left me drained in the Hendrix. Ortega's phone shrilled. She unpocketed it and answered, still chewing her last mouthful.
"Yeah? Uh-huh. Uh-huh, good. No, we'll go."
Her eyes flickered briefly to mine.
"That so? No, leave that one, too. It'll keep. Yeah, thanks, Zach. Owe you one."
She stowed the phone again and resumed eating. "Good news?"
"Depends on your point of view. They traced the two local calls, one to a fight drone over in Richmond, place I know. We'll go down and take a look."
"And the other call?" Ortega looked up at me from her bowl, chewed and swallowed.
"The other number was a residential discreet. Bancroft residence. Suntouch House. Now what exactly do you make of that?"
Chapter 19. Ortega's fight drone was an ancient bulk carrier, moored up in the north end of the bay, alongside acres of abandoned warehouses. The vessel must have been over a half a kilometer long, with six clearly discernible cargo cells between stem and stern. The one at the rear appeared to be open. From the air, the body of the carrier was a uniform orange that I assumed was rust.
"Don't let it fool you," Ortega grunted as we circled. "They've polymered the hull a quarter meter thick all over. Take a shaped charge to sink it now."
"Expensive." She shrugged.
"They've got the backing."
We landed on the quay. Ortega killed the motors and leaned across me to peer up at the ship's superstructure, which, at a glance, appeared to be deserted. I pushed myself back into the seat a little, discomforted in equal parts by the pressure of the lithe torso in my lap and my slightly overfull stomach. She felt the movement, seemed suddenly to realize what she was doing, and pulled herself abruptly upright again.
"No one home,"
she said awkwardly.
"So it seems. Shall we go and have a look?"
We got out into the customary blanket snap of wind off the bay and made for a tubular aluminum gangway that led onto the vessel near the stern.
It was uncomfortably open ground, and I crossed it with an eye constantly sweeping the railed and craned lines of the ship's deck and bridge tower. Nothing stirred. I squeezed my left arm lightly against my side to check that the fiber grip holster hadn't slipped down, as the cheaper varieties often did after a couple of days' wear. With the Nemex, I was tolerably sure I could air out anyone shooting at us from the rail. In any event, it wasn't necessary. We reached the end of the gangway without incident. A slim chain was fixed across the open entrance with a hand-lettered sign hung on it. Panama Rose. Fight tonight, 2200. Gate price double. I lifted the rectangle of thin metal and looked at the crude lettering dubiously. Are you sure Rutherford called here?
Like I said, don't let it fool you.
Ortega was unhooking the chain.
Fighter chic. Crude's the in thing. Last season it was neon signs, but even that's not cool enough now. Place is fucking globally hyped. Only about 3 or 4 like it on the planet. There's no coverage allowed in the arenas. No hollows, not even televisuals. You coming or what?
Weird. I followed her down the tubular corridor, thinking of the freak fights I'd gone to when I was younger. On Harlan's world, all fights were broadcast. They got the highest viewing figures of any transmitted entertainment online.
Don't people like watching this sort of stuff?
Yes, of course they do.
Even with the distortion of the echoing corridor, I could hear Ortega's lip curling in the tone of her voice.
Never get enough of it. That's how this scam works. See, first they set up the creed.
Creed?
Yeah, creed of purity or some such shit. Didn't anyone ever tell you it's rude to interrupt? Creed goes, you want to see the fight, you go see it in the flesh. That's better than watching it on the web. More classy. So limited audience seating, sky-high demand. That makes the tickets very sexy, which makes them very expensive, which makes them even more sexy, and whoever thought of it just rides that spiral up through the roof.
Smart.
Yeah, smart.
We came to the end of the gangway and stepped out again onto a wind-whipped deck. On either side of us, the roofing of 2 of the cargo cells swelled smoothly to waist height like 2 enormous steel blisters on the ship's skin. Beyond the rear swelling, the bridge towered blankly into the sky, seeming entirely unconnected with the hull we were standing on. The only motion came from the chains of a loading crane ahead of us that the wind had set swinging fractionally.
The last time I was out here,
Ortega said, raising her voice to compete with the wind,
was because some dipshit news prick from World Web One got caught trying to walk recording implants into a title fight. They threw him into the bay. After they'd removed the implants with a pair of pliers.
Nice.
Like I said, it's a classy place.
Such flattery, Lieutenant. I hardly know how to respond.
The voice coughed from rusty-looking loudspeaker horns set on 2-meter-high stalks along the rail. My hand flew to the Nemec's butt, and my vision cycled out to peripheral scan with a rapidity that hurt. Ortega gave me an almost imperceptible shake of the head and looked up at the bridge. The 2 of us swept the superstructure for movement in opposite directions, coordinating unconsciously. Under the immediacy of the tension, I felt a warm shiver of pleasure at that unlooked-for symmetry.
No, over here, the metallic voice said,
this time relegated to the horns to the stern. As I watched, the chains on one of the rear loading cranes grated into motion and began to run, presumably hauling something up from the open cell in front of the bridge. I left my hand on the Nemex. Overhead, the sun was breaking through the cloud cover. The chain ended in a massive iron hook, in the crook of which stood the speaker, one hand still holding a prehistoric microphone, the other gripped lightly around the rising chain. He was dressed in an inappropriate-looking gray suit that flapped in the wind, leaning out from the chain at a fastidious angle, hair glinting in a wandering shaft of sunlight. I narrowed my eyes to confirm. Synthetic. Cheap synthetic. The crane swung out over the curved cover of the cargo cell, and the synth alighted elegantly on the top, looking down on us.
"Elias Riker," he said,
and his voice was not much smoother than the tannoy had been. Someone had done a real cut-rate job on the vocal cords. He shook his head.
We thought we'd seen the last of you. How short the legislature's memory. Carnage?
Ortega lifted a hand to shade against the sudden sunlight.
That you?
The synthetic bowed faintly and stowed the mic inside his jacket. He began to pick his way down the sloping cell cover.
M.C. Carnage, at your service, officers. And pray, what have we done to offend today?
I said nothing. From the sound of it, I was supposed to know this Carnage, and I didn't have enough to work with at the moment. Remembering what Ortega had told me, I fixed the approaching synth with a blank stare, and hoped I was being sufficiently Riker-like. The synthetic reached the edge of the cell cover and jumped down. Up close, I saw that it wasn't only the vocal cords that were crude. This body was so far from the one Trep had been using when I torched her, it was barely deserving of the same name. I wondered briefly if it was some kind of antique. The black hair was coarse and enameled-looking. The face, slack silico flesh. The pale blue eyes, clearly logoed across the white. The body looked solid, but a little too solid, and the arms were slightly wrong, reminiscent of snakes rather than limbs. The hands at the ends of the cuffs were smooth and lineless. The synth offered one featureless palm, as if for inspection.
Well? He asked gently. Routine check, Carnage, Ortega said, helping me out. Been some bomb threats on tonight's fight. We're here to have a look.
Carnage laughed jarringly.
As if you cared.
Well, like I said, Ortega answered evenly, it's routine.
Oh, well, you'd better come along, then.
The synthetic sighed and nodded at me.
What's the matter with him? Did they lose his speech functions in the stack?
We followed him toward the back of the ship and found ourselves skirting the pit formed by the rolled-back cover of the rearmost cargo cell. I glanced down inside and saw a circular white fighting ring, walled on four sides by slopes of steel and plastic seating. Banks of lighting equipment were strung above, but they were none of the spiky spherical units I associated with telemetry. In the center of the ring, someone was kneeling, painting a design on the mat by hand, and looked up as we passed.
Thematic, Carnage said, seeing where I was looking. Means something in Arabic. This season's fights are all themed around protectorate police actions. Tonight it's Sharia, right hand of God martyrs versus Protect Marines, hand to hand, no blades over 10 centimeters.
Bloodbath, in other words, Ortega said.
The synth shrugged.
What the public wants, the public pays for. I understand it is possible to inflict an outright mortal wound with a 10-centimeter blade, just very difficult. A real test of skill, they say. This way.
We went down a narrow companionway into the body of the ship, our own footsteps clanging around us in the tight confines.
Arenas first, I presume,
Carnage shouted above the echoes. No, let's see the tanks first.
Ortega suggested.
Really?
It was hard to tell with a low-grade synthetic voice, but Carnage seemed to be amused.
Are you quite sure it's a bomb you're looking for, Lieutenant? It seems to me the arena would be the obvious place to...
Got something to hide, Carnage?
The synthetic turned back to look at me for a moment, quizzically.
No, not at all, Detective Riker. The tanks it is, then. Welcome to the conversation, by the way. Was it cold on stack? Of course, you probably never expected to be there yourself.
That's enough, Ortega interposed herself. Just take us to the tanks and save the small talk for tonight.
But, of course, we aim to cooperate with law enforcement as a legally incorporated...
Yeah, yeah,
Ortega waved the verbiage away with weary patience.
Just take us to the fucking tanks.
I reverted to my dangerous stare. We rode to the tank area in a dinky little electromag train that ran along one side of the hull, through two more converted cargo cells equipped with the same fighting rings and banks of seats, but this time covered over with plastic sheeting. At the far end, we disembarked and stepped through the customary sonic cleansing lock. A great deal dirtier than Psychosex facilities. Ostensibly made of black iron, the heavy door swung outward to reveal a spotlessly white interior.
At this point we dispense with image, Carnage said carelessly. bare-bones low-tech is all very well for the audience, but behind the scenes, well...
He gestured around the gleaming facilities.
You can't make an omelet without a little oil in the pan.
The forward cargo section was huge and chilly, the lighting gloomy, the technology aggressively massive. Where Bancroft's low-lit womb mausoleum at Psychosec had spoken in soft, cultured tones of the trappings of wealth, where the resleeving room at Bay City Storage Facility had groaned minimal funding for minimal deservers, the Panama Rosa's body bank was a brutal growl of power. The storage tubes were racked on heavy chains like torpedoes on either side of us, jacked into a central monitor system at one end of the hold via thick black cables that twisted across the floor like pythons. The monitor unit itself squatted heavily ahead of us like an altar to some unpleasant spider god. We approached it on a metal jetty raised a quarter meter above the frozen writhings of the data cables. Behind it to the left and right, set into the far wall, were the square glass sides of two spacious decanting tanks. The right-hand tank already held a sleeve, floating backlit and tethered cruciform by monitor lines. It was like walking into the Andra Cathedral in New Pest. Carnage walked to the central monitor, turned, and spread his arms rather like the sleeve above and behind him.
"Where would you like to start? I assume you've brought sophisticated bomb detection equipment with you."
Ortega ignored him. She took a couple of steps closer to the decanting tank and looked up into the wash of cool green light it cast down into the gloom.
"This one of tonight's whores?" she asked.
Carnage sniffed.
"In not so many words, it is. I do wish you'd understand the difference between what they peddle in those greasy little shops down the coast and this."
"So do I," Ortega told him, eyes still upward on the body.
"Where'd you get this one, then?" "How should I know?"
Carnage made a show of studying the plastic nails on his right hand.
"Oh, we have the bill of sale somewhere, if you must look. By the look of him, I'd say this one's out of Nippon Organics, or one of the Pacific Rim combines. Does it really matter?"
I went to the wall and stared up at the floating sleeve. Slim, hard-looking, and brown, with the delicately lifted Japanese eyes on the shelf of unscalably high cheekbones, a thick, straight drift of impenetrably black hair like seaweed in the tank fluid, gracefully flexible with the long hands of an artist, but muscled for speed combat. It was the body of a tech ninja, the body I'd dreamed about having at 15, on dreary, rain-filled days in New Pest. It wasn't far off the sleeve they'd given me to fight the Sharia war in. It was a variation on the sleeve I'd bought with my first big payoff in Millsport, the sleeve I'd met Sarah in. It was like looking at myself under glass, the self I'd built somewhere in the coils of memory that trail all the way back to childhood. Suddenly, I stood, exiled in the Caucasian flesh, on the wrong side of the mirror. Carnage came up to me and slapped the glass.
"You approve, Detective Riker?"
When I said nothing, he went on.
"I'm sure you do, someone with your appetite for, well, brawling. The specs are quite remarkable. Reinforced chassis. The bones are all culture-grown marrow alloy jointed with polybond ligamenting, carbon-reinforced tendons, Kumalo Nurichem."
"Gut Nurichem," I said, for something to say.
"I know all about your Nurichem, Detective Riker."
Even through the poor quality voice, I thought I could hear a soft, sticky delight.
"The fight drones scanned your specs when you were on stack. There was some talk of buying you up, you know. Physically, I mean. It was thought your sleeve could be used in a humiliation bout. Faked, of course. We would never dream of the actual thing here. That would be, well, criminal."
Carnage paused dramatically.
"But then it was decided that humiliation fights were not the spirit of the establishment. A lowering of tone, you understand. Not a real contest. Shame, really. With all the friends you've made, it would have been a big crowd-puller."
I wasn't really listening to him, but it dawned on me that Riker was being insulted, and I pivoted away from the glass to fix Carnage with what seemed like an appropriate glare.
But I digress, the synthetic went on smoothly. What I meant to say is that your Nurikem is to this system, as my voice is to that of Ankana Salamau. This,
he gestured once more at the tank,
is Kumalo Nurikem, patented by Cape Neuronics only last year, a development of almost spiritual proportions. There are no synaptic chemical amplifiers, no servo chips or implanted wiring. The system is grown in, and it responds directly to thought. Consider that, Detective. No one off-world has it yet. The UN is thought to be considering a 10-year colonial embargo, though I myself doubt the efficacy of such...
Carnage! Ortega drifted in behind him impatiently. Why haven't you decanted the other fighter yet?
But we are, Lieutenant!
Carnage waved one hand at the rack of body tubes on the left. From behind them came the sound of prowling heavy machinery. I peered into the gloom and made out a big automated forklift unit rolling down the rows of containers. As we watched, it locked to a stop, and bright directed lighting sprang up on its frame. The forks reached and clamped on a tube, extracting it from the chained cradle, while smaller servos disconnected the cabling from it. Separation complete, the machine withdrew slightly, swiveled about, and trundled back along the rows toward the empty decanting tank.
The system is entirely automated, Carnage said superfluously.
Below the tank, I now noticed a line of three circular openings, like the forward discharge ports of an IP dreadnought. The forklift rose up a little on hydraulic pistons and loaded the tube it was carrying smoothly into the center port. The tube fit snugly, the visible end rotating through about 90 degrees before a steel baffle slammed down over it. The task completed, the forklift sank back down on its hydraulics, and its engines died. I watched the tank. It seemed like a while, but in fact probably took less than a minute. A hatch broke open in the floor of the tank, and a silvery shoal of bubbles erupted upward. Drifting after them came the body. It bobbed feebly for a moment, turning this way and that in the eddies caused by the air. Then its arms and legs began to unfold, aided by the gently tugging monitor wires secured at wrist and ankle. It was bigger bone than the Kumalo sleeve, blocky and more heavily muscled, but similar in color. A strong-boned, hawk-nosed visage tipped lazily toward us as the thin wires pulled it upright.
"Sharian, right hand of God, martyr," Carnage said beamingly. "Not really, of course, but the race type's accurate, and it's got an authentic will-of-God-enhanced response system."
He nodded at the other tank.
"The Marines on Sharia were multiracial, but there were enough Jap types there to make it believable."
"Not much of a contest, is it?" I said. "State-of-the-art Nurikem against century-old Sharian biomech." Carnage grinned with his slack, silico-flesh face.
"Well, that will depend on the fighters. I'm told the Kumalo system takes a bit of getting used to, and to be honest, it isn't always the best sleeve that wins. It's more about psychology, endurance, pain tolerance."
"Savagery," Ortega added. "Lack of empathy."
"Things like that," the synthetic agreed. "That's what makes it exciting, of course. If you'd care to come tonight, Lieutenant, Detective, I'm sure I can find you a couple of remaindered seats near the back."
"You'll be commentating?" I surmised, already hearing the specs' rich vocabulary that Carnage used come tumbling out over the loudspeaker, the killing ring drenched in focused white light, the roaring, surging crowd in the darkened seating, the smell of sweat and bloodlust.
"Of course I will." Carnage's logoed eyes narrowed. "You haven't been away so long, you know." "Are we going to look for these bombs?"
Ortega said loudly. It took us over an hour to go over the hold, looking for imaginary bombs, while Carnage looked on with poorly veiled amusement. Up above, the two sleeves destined for slaughter in the arena looked down on us from their green-lit glass-sided wombs, and their presences weighed no less heavily for their closed eyes and dreaming visages. Chapter 20
Ortega dropped me on Mission Street as evening was falling over the city. She'd been withdrawn and monosyllabic on the flight back from the fight drone, and I guessed the strain of reminding herself I was not Riker was beginning to take a toll. But when I made a production out of brushing off my shoulders as I got out of the cruiser, she laughed impulsively.
"Stick around the Hendrix tomorrow," she said. "There's someone I want you to talk to, but it'll take a while to set up."
"Fair enough." I turned to go.
"Kovac."
I turned back. She was leaning across to look up and out of the open door at me. I put an arm on the uplifted door wing of the cruiser and looked down. There was a longish pause during which I could feel my blood beginning to adrenalize gently.
"Yes?"
She hesitated a moment longer, then said, "Carnage was hiding something back there, right?" From the amount he talked, I'd say yes.
"That's what I thought."
She prodded hurriedly at the control console, and the door began to slide back down.
"See you tomorrow."
I watched the cruiser lift into the sky and sighed. I was reasonably sure that going to Ortega openly had been a good move, but I hadn't expected it to be so messy. However long she and Riker had been together, the chemistry must have been devastating. I remembered reading somewhere how the initial pheromones of attraction between bodies appeared to undergo a form of encoding the longer said bodies were in proximity, binding them increasingly close. None of the biochemists interviewed appeared to really understand the process, but there had been some attempts to play with it in labs. Speeding up or interrupting had met with mixed results, one of which was empathin and its derivatives. Chemicals. I was still reeling from the cocktail of Miriam Bancroft, and I didn't need this. I told myself in no uncertain terms I didn't need this. Up ahead, over the heads of the evening's scattered pedestrians, I saw the holographic bulk of the left-handed guitar player outside the Hendrix. I sighed again and started walking. Halfway up the block, a bulky automated vehicle rolled past me, hugging the curb. It looked pretty much like the robo-crawlers that cleaned the streets of Millsport, so I paid no attention to it as it drew level. Seconds later, I was drenched in the machine's image cast.
"From the houses, from 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 the houses."
The voices groaned and murmured, male, female, overlaid. It was like a choir in the throes of orgasm. The images were inescapable, varying across a broad spectrum of sexual preference, a whirlwind of fleeting sensory impressions. Genuine. Uncut. Full-sense repro. Tailored. As if to prove this last, the random images thinned out into a stream of heterosex combinations. They must have scanned my response to the blur of options and fed directly back to the broadcast unit. Very high tech. The flow ended with a phone number in glowing numerals and an erect penis in the hands of a woman with long, dark hair and a crimson-lipped smile. She looked into the lens. I could feel her fingers.
"Head in the clouds," she breathed. "This is what it's like. Maybe you can't afford to come up here, but you can certainly afford this."
Her head dipped. Her lips slid down over the penis. Like it was happening to me. Then the long black hair curtained in from either side and inked the image out. I was back on the street, swaying, coated in a thin sheen of sweat. The autocaster grumbled away down the street behind me, some of the more streetwise pedestrians skipping sharply sideways out of its cast radius. I found I could recall the phone number with gleaming clarity. The sweat cooled rapidly to a shiver. I flexed my shoulders and started walking, trying not to notice the knowing looks of the people around me. I was almost into a full stride again when a gap opened in the strollers ahead, and I saw the long, low limousine parked outside the Hendrix's front doors. Jangling nerves sent my hand leaping toward the holstered Nemex before I recognized the vehicle as Bancroft's. Forcing out a deep breath, I circled the limousine and ascertained that the driver's compartment was empty. I was still wondering what to do when the rear compartment hatch cracked open,
and Curtis unfolded himself from the seating inside.
"We need to talk, Kovach,"
he said in a man-to-man sort of voice that put me on the edge of a slightly hysterical giggle.
"Decision time."
I looked him up and down, reckoned from the tiny eddies in his stance and demeanor that he was chemically augmented at the moment, and decided to humor him.
"Sure. In the limo?"
"It's cramped in there. How about you ask me up to your room?"
My eyes narrowed. There was an unmistakable hostility in the chauffeur's voice, and a just as unmistakable hard-on pressing at the front of his immaculate chinos. Granted, I had a similar, if detumescing, lump of my own, but I remembered distinctly that Bancroft's limo had shielding against the streetcasts. This was something else. I nodded at the hotel entrance.
"Okay, let's go."
The doors parted to let us in, and the Hendricks came to life.
"Good evening, sir. You have no visitors this evening."
Curtis snorted.
"Disappointed, huh, Kovach?" "Nor any calls since you left,"
the hotel continued smoothly.
"Do you wish this person admitted as a guest?"
"Yeah, sure. You got a bar we can go to?"
"I said your room,"
Curtis growled behind me, then yelped as he barked his shin on one of the lobby's low, metal-edged tables.
"The Midnight Lamp Bar is located on this floor," the hotel said doubtfully, "but it has not been used for a considerable time." "I said..."
"Shut up, Curtis. Didn't anyone ever tell you not to rush a first date? The Midnight Lamp is fine. Fire it up for us." Across the lobby, adjacent to the check-in console, a wide section of the back wall slid grudgingly aside, and lights flickered on in the space beyond. With Curtis making sneering sounds behind me, I went to the opening and peered down a short flight of steps into the Midnight Lamp Bar.
"This'll do fine. Come on."
Someone over-literal in imagination had done the interior decoration of the Midnight Lamp Bar. The walls, themselves psychedelic whirls of midnight blues and purples, were festooned with a variety of clock faces showing either the declared hour or a few minutes too, interwoven with every form of lamp known to man, from clay prehistoric to enzyme decay light canisters. There was indented bench seating along both walls, clock-face tables, and in the center of the room a circular bar in the shape of a countdown dial. A robot composed entirely of clocks and lamps waited immobile just beside the dial's 12 mark. It was all the more eerie for the complete absence of any other customers, and as we made our way toward the waiting robot, I could feel Curtis's earlier mood quiet a little.
"What will it be, gentlemen?" the machine said unexpectedly, from no apparent vocal outlet.
Its face was an antique white analog clock with spider-thin Baroque hands and the hours marked off in Roman numerals. A little unnerved, I turned back to Curtis, whose face was showing signs of unwilling sobriety.
"Vodka,"
he said shortly.
"Sub-zero."
"And a whiskey. Whatever it is I've been drinking out of the cabinet in my room. At room temperature, please. Both on my tab."
The clock face inclined slightly, and one multi-jointed arm swung up to select glasses from an overhead rack. The other arm, which ended in a lamp with a forest of small spouts, trickled the requested spirits into the glasses. Curtis picked up his glass and threw a generous portion of the vodka down his throat. He drew breath hard through his teeth and made a satisfied growling noise. I sipped at my own glass a little more circumspectly, wondering how long it had been since liquid last flowed through the bar's tubes and spigots. My fears proved unfounded, so I deepened the sip and let the whiskey melt its way down into my stomach. Curtis banged down his glass.
"Now you ready to talk?"
"All right, Curtis," I said slowly, looking into my drink. "I imagine you have a message for me."
"Sure have."
His voice was cranked to snapping point.
"The lady says you're going to take her very generous offer or not. Just that. I'm supposed to give you time to make up your mind, so I'll finish my drink."
I fixed my gaze on a Martian sand lamp hanging from the opposite wall. Curtis's mood was beginning to make some sense.
"Muscling in on your territory, am I?"
"Don't push your luck, Kovach."
There was a desperate edge to the words.
"You say the wrong thing here, and I'll..."
"You'll what?" I set my glass down and turned to face him. He was less than half my subjective age, young and muscled and chemically wound up in the illusion that he was dangerous. He reminded me so much of myself at the same age, it was maddening. I wanted to shake him.
"You'll what?" Curtis gulped. "I was in the Provincial Marines."
"What as, a pin-up?" I went to push him in the chest with one stiffened hand, then dropped it, ashamed. I lowered my voice. "Listen, Curtis, don't do this to us both."
"You think you're pretty fucking tough, don't you?"
"This isn't about tough, Curtis." I'd almost called him kid. It seemed as if part of me wanted the fight after all. "This is about two different species. What did they teach you in the Provincial Marines? Hand-to-hand combat? 27 ways to kill a man with your hands? Underneath it all, you're still a man. I'm an envoy, Curtis. It's not the same." He came for me anyway, leading with a straight jab that was supposed to distract me, while the following roundhouse kick scythed in from the side at head height. It was a skullcracker if it landed, but it was hopelessly overdramatic. Maybe it was the chemicals he'd dressed up in that night. No one in their right mind throws kicks above the waist height in a real fight. I ducked the jab and the kick in the same movement and grabbed his foot. A sharp twist and Curtis tipped, staggered, and landed spread-eagled on the bar top. I smashed his face against the unyielding surface and held him there with my hand knotted in his hair. "See what I mean?" He made muffled noises and thrashed impotently about while the clock-faced bartender stood immobile. Blood from his broken nose was streaked across the bar's surface. I studied the patterns it had made while I brought my breathing back down. The lock I had on my conditioning was making me pant. Shifting my grip to his right arm, I jerked it up high into the small of his back. The thrashing stopped.
"Good. Now you keep still or I'll break it. I'm not in the mood for this."
As I spoke, I was feeling rapidly through his pockets. In the inner breast pouch of his jacket, I found a small plastic tube.
"Aha! So what little delights have we got tubing around your system tonight?
Hormone enhancers, by the look of that hard-on." I held the tube up to dim light and saw thousands of tiny crystal slivers inside.
"Military format. Where did you get this stuff, Curtis? Discharge freebie from the Marines, was it?"
I recommenced my search and came up with a delivery system. A tiny skeletal gun with a sliding chamber and a magnetic coil. Tip the crystals into the breech and close it. The magnetic field aligns them, and the accelerator spits them out at penetrative speed. Not so different from Sarah's shard pistol. For battlefield medics, they were a hardy and consequently very popular alternative to hyposprays.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.